Welcome, everybody. I'm going to probably start in just a few minutes, but in case there's latecomers who are still finding their way here. But just for fun, something, I've only done a few tours since you guys know that we made detected gravitational waves, right?
Yep.
This is my first time doing like a big tour, a big public tour since the announcement. So I was kind of afraid. I was wondering how big of an audience we'd have. Usually I do some of our public tours, and I actually did one and no one showed up. So that was pre-detection, though. But just to kind of get you in the mood, or just to, I don't know, for fun, I don't know if any of you have seen this video. I love this video, and it's actually on my iPod. I play it all the time. But this is just a scientist who also was sharing in our excitement, and it's just a little music video about some of our recent work. So I'll play that for you guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
Too much. It's kind of kind of hard to see, but this is the building that we're in now. And so I went up to the corner station to go see how the control room looked. Because later on, we're going to walk around the site, and then I'm going to hand you off to some of the scientists that are working in the control room today doing commissioning work. So it's a good thing I went up there, because when I went in there, there was more people than usual, and I was wondering what's going on. And so it turns out that we had a power outage last night. So unfortunately, I don't know if we'll have light in the arms today, so that's always a nice thing to look at, but at least this gives you the opportunity to see the rare thing of scientists in their natural elements, scurrying around trying to make things come back online. Sometimes I have a tendency to talk fast, so I wrote a couple notes here so that I don't forget certain things. Feel free to take any kind of photos you want. You can check in on Facebook or do anything like that, but take any kind of pictures you want. If you have questions, feel free to interrupt me to help slow me down. What else did I say? Another unique thing for this particular tour is that you're here just a few days before the anniversary of that first detection that we had. So the detection happened on September 14th, 2015, and so Wednesday is going to be the anniversary of when those gravitational waves passed through the Earth and continued on. So they're now one light year away from the Earth in whatever direction they were going. So that's a unique thing for today. What else? So another thing that's going to happen with this tour is we're going to walk around the site, but we're probably, because of the size of the audience, is we'll probably split the group up into at least two or three different groups. And Amber is one of our outreach coordinators. She's going to also help me here today, and she'll help kind of herd the group all around the site. And so there's this component, which I'll try to keep it maybe 30 to 45 minutes. And then we'll go walk around the site. I might also go through some of the stuff that's out in the lobby. I have to go through some of that stuff. And then we'll walk around outside. We'll take, there's a couple of exhibits out there we can look at. And then the control room. And we'll just kind of rotate these groups around so that everybody gets to see it today. What else? Okay, I took the gun out of my mouth. So that's gone. the public tours are run by the scientists that work here. Or just the staff that work here. So it sometimes can be the person who runs the whole site, that'd be my boss, Fred Robb, or it could be one of the commissioners who does work on the machine actively all the time. I'm one of the operators who work here. So I started here way back in 1998, and this was my first job after college. So I received a BS degree in physics and applied math, and then this was in California, and I saw a job announcement for an optics specialist up here. And so this was my chance to get to the Pacific Northwest, and so I've been here ever since, and I love it. And so as an operator, when I first moved here, I was one of the people who helped build the detector. So a lot of that equipment that's outside, some of that is things that I'm very intimate with. I've turned and torqued thousands of bolts, so I know the machine fairly intimately because of that. And then building the machine is one thing, another thing is just running it. So as an operator, we have a team of 9 operators currently, and the operators are the ones who work on shift when the machine is running, and just keep it running so that it collects data. So that's what we will be doing probably within the next couple months. So if I say acronyms, please interrupt me and tell me, what is it? What are you talking about? So one acronym that's worth noting is O1. That stands for Observation Run 1. And so O1 happened almost a year ago. So that's when we started to collect data for the first time between both of our detectors, one in Louisiana and one here in Washington State. And we have O1 and an engineering run. So engineering run is, we have the machine, it's pretty much running and ready to go, but we also do a lot of testing, calibration work, and other things, usually during the day, and then at night is when we kick the scientists out, and then we let the machines collect data. And it's during an engineering run is when we made that first detection. And so right now, we're kind of in a similar situation. We're hoping to start an engineering run in the next few weeks or months. So that's what I'm kind of waiting for. And then we'll be starting O2 after that engineering run, which is about a month. So prior to first detection, most of my tours had consisted of me talking about what I did with the detector. So it'd be a lot of pictures of me in a clean room suit and talking about the things that I was building, the work that we've done with the machine. And so a lot of it was focused on that. But ever since the detection, we've kind of had to change our script a little bit because now we're totally legit because we not only made our first detection, we made two. Actually, it's two and a half. There was one that was a trigger that just wasn't quite loud enough, but if we didn't make that first detection, which was a huge one, it was a big signal, we would have counted that trigger as a detection, I think. But so two and a half detections are what we made in that first time segment. So roughly August to January. That's when we were collecting data last year. And now we're getting ready to get to a point where we can start collecting data again. And so as somebody who is a wrench turner, it's kind of a new thing, because I also do outreach stuff. It's a new thing for me to kind of learn about the astrophysics, what we're doing, because I was very focused on building this machine and running it. So it's completely different now. So I'm sweating too, sorry, excuse me. We didn't have HVAC last night because of the power outage. And I'm talking fast. I'm going to slow down. So
I have a question. What percentage of the time are you actually collecting data with the machine?
That's a good question. Yeah, I'll talk about that later. But the machines, if you're an operator, you kind of see them as creatures, like living creatures. It's not like you could just turn a switch and that this machine here can just be collecting data. We have all these mirrors, we have a laser, we have computers that run a lot of this stuff, and they're always in flux, so we can't just turn it on and just collect data. We have to align things, we have to make sure that everything's quiet environmentally. If there's storms out at sea, out near Iceland or way out in New Zealand, if they're big storms, we can see those. Those will move our mirrors around. So additionally, if there's wind storms that are big enough, so if it's over 40 miles an hour, we can usually get to a point where we can collect data, but usually the walls of all our buildings are moving enough so that they're shaking the foundations and shaking our mirrors around. And so those are a lot of the enemies that we have. Those are the easy ones to talk about. So seismic noise is the big thing. So as an operator, you want to have a fairly boring shift. You want your machine to be up and collecting data so no one will get mad at you. You're doing what you're supposed to do. But that's just one component. So we have two machines too. So even if we made it, if our machine here was running and collecting data, if an event happened to occur and we recorded it, we won't really consider it anything because we need to have the other machine going. So both of them both have to be up and collecting data. So that's the balancing act that we have to always orchestrate between both sites. But because if we just have one detection on one machine, we just don't want to count that. So that's the thing that we have. So every time when we're running and we're collecting data, we want to make sure both machines are up and collecting data at the best sensitivity possible. And I'll show some graphs of those later in my talk right now. And so instead of talking about putting this machine together, I'll kind of focus on what our machine is, how it works, and then the detection that we made. And then, like I said, feel free to ask any questions.
How many operations do you have? Like you said, one, and you're working on two.
What's that?
How many operations are there?
Yes, okay, so LIGO consists of two observatories here in Washington and Louisiana. And then we used to have a smaller detector here. So when I talk about detector, that's what we see here. And we'll refer to the arm length. So these guys are 4 kilometer long arms. We used to have two of them here. We used to have one with 4 kilometer long. The mirror would be way down here, 4 kilometers away. But we also used to have, for the first generation of machine we had one that was shorter. So it had 2 kilometer long arms. And so that one we decided not to build for Advanced LIGO. That's the machine that we have now at both sites. And we did make it. We made all the components for it, but we boxed all of them up in the hopes that we could have another detector built somewhere on the planet. So we could have three of these detectors on the planet. So right after the announcement happened, it was officially announced that India was going to be making payment for this new detector. So all these parts that we have boxed up now have a place to go. And so that's the hope. So I forgot what year, do you know, Amber, what year India is supposed to come online?
I actually don't.
It's probably going to be another 5 to 7 years from now when we have 3 LIGO detectors. So that's LIGO. But there's other groups in the world that are also going on now. So O2, which is going to be starting in the coming weeks, is going to also include Italy. So Italy is going to have their detector, hopefully joining us in the spring. So that will be the three of us, you know, Louisiana in here, Virgo in Italy. Germany has one, but it's a lot smaller machine, so it's a smaller detector. I think it's 500 meter long arm, so we'll have those four detectors for O2. Japan is also making one. They're building their machine. It's a 3 kilometer long arm machine, and that's inside of a mine in a mountain in Japan. So they're probably not going to join us until 2019, I think. So we're building up an array of these detectors around the planet. So yeah.
Just wondering, I've been to the one in Louisiana as well. Do you know if it was affected by all the flooding?
So luckily, the only real effects for the flooding were to staff. So people who lived in, I think, Hammond or some of the nearby cities, I think there's at least five people who had houses that were flooded for sure. Yeah, so I think they just closed the site for a few days, but a lot of the other staff are just recovering from it. Yeah.
On the graph out there, there's a list of five or six detections, gravity detections.
Yeah.
You said you've done two. Who did the other ones?
So there's a list of X-ray detections, and so
right.
That's electromagnetic.
And above that, it said gravity in one color.
Yeah, there are nine in red.
I think, I'm trying to remember that graph. I think it's looking at the two black holes. I think each detection has three data points on there.
Oh, okay.
I think the two black holes that were in spiraling towards each other, and then the resultant one. So there's three for each of those events
okay.
that we have. So that's, yeah. Yeah.
Is the choice of Washington and Louisiana just a random choice, or was there some physics or geological reason?
Yeah, I think it's political and budgetary
okay.
reasons.
Okay. I mean,
yeah, I mean, Caltech and MIT are the universities who run this project. They would have liked to have had one detector in the high desert of Southern California and then another one in Maine, just for the same amount of frequent flyer. No, you wouldn't get frequent flyer miles, but that would have been preferred. But I think here it was for budgetary reasons because it's on the Hanford site, so I think that was a reason for it. And I'm not totally sure for Louisiana how it got chosen down there. Yeah. So, okay.
What does the detection of two events within a small space of time imply about the frequency of these events? And has anybody made any predictions for the next time you turn LIGO on as to how many events you're going to have?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to give you guys one page that'll have a link to the papers that we generated for these detections. And so when we had the first event, you can't really get too much statistics from that, but I think some of there was some ways of doing it. That's beyond me. But after we made the next detection, that made it a little easier to get an idea of statistics. And so I'll probably refer you to those papers to look at those. And the papers are actually something I hope everybody gets to look at. I mean, they're actually not that tough of a read, and they're fairly short. And I mean, this is my baby. I guess I think they're exciting to read. I'm always like reading the papers, but I'll point that to you later at the end of this talk or presentation.
Kind of on Howard's thing, but you said earlier when both sites aren't operating at their capacity, I guess.
Yeah.
But you detect one on one, but you don't want to count that one. How many were there like that?
That's a good question. I don't know. So a lot of our data, it's just crazy how things are different. So there's been two iterations of our project. So there was initial LIGO, which is what I helped build way back in 98. And then there's Advanced LIGO, which we turned the switch on last year. So when we were operating the first machine, we didn't make any detections with that one. But as far as
official ones are just like, hey, that seemed like it had the curve that we were looking for.
There was excitement towards the end of one of our last science runs, but it ended up being an injection that we were putting in to test our scientists. So, but one thing to say is that back then, as an operator sitting in the control room, I never thought that if I happened to be running the machine, would I be able to know that we had a detection happen while I was in the chair? And back then, I would definitely say no. I thought it would take us, you know, months to a year for data analysis to sit through that data. But so much has changed since then. So, what is it? Numerical relativity made huge steps in the last few years. So I think in 2005, they were able to solve the equation, Einstein's gravitational field equations, to a point where we were able to get all these filters and templates to use them to look at our data, and it's almost in real time. So, I have a talk here, but there's so many other things I could talk about. I mean, I just want to talk about, what's that? Okay. But that night is also exciting, though. I mean, I'd like to talk about that night when the detection happened, because I was actually here, so I'd like to talk about that, because it's kind of related to what you're talking about. We can look, we have supercomputers and a data analysis system that is that can almost work on the data, look at it in real time. And so that night was just an exciting night. I was sleeping, but when I woke up, it was just crazy to see all the emails and traffic that we had the morning after this guy. Okay, so I'm just going to kind of slip through this. I'm mainly going to focus on how the machine works and the detection, but I should have thrown in a picture of Einstein on this one at least, because everything that we're doing here is because of Einstein and his mind, because we wouldn't be anywhere without his general theory of relativity. And I'm sure a lot of you are familiar that in contrast to Newton, Einstein just had a different way of thinking about how gravity works. And it's kind of illustrated here in these pictures. So instead of a force between two objects, all objects, even us, or that trash can there, all of us have an effect on the space or space-time around us. So the bigger the object is, you're going to cause a bigger dimple in space-time. And that's what we're kind of seeing here. And then you can see also Earth here, also with a little dimple. And Earth is just in its orbit, kind of continually orbiting around the sun. And that's how Einstein looked at that's how he explained gravity. And so if we could just remove the Earth and just have this star here, or any heavy object there, that's just a static example of gravity. But if you were to have two big objects, so not, the Earth's not quite big enough, it has a little tiny, little dent in the space-time there, but if you have two bigger objects, and the fun ones to do are black holes or neutron stars, and if you had them moving around in space, so if you had a kinetic example, if you had these two heavy, strong gravity objects that really totally distort the space around them, space-time around them, that's where a lot of crazy and exciting things happen. And those are the things that we were hoping to detect with our machine, and we did. And so this is just a computer simulation of what two black holes look like when they're just about ready to merge into each other. And so it looks like they're kind of spinning around in a fluid, but the kind of fluid nature that you're seeing there is the light from the stars behind them being bent around these two heavy, these two strong gravity objects as right before they merge. And that would be happening right there. And so that's what we call a merger, or I guess you could say there's a few phases to it. So there's the in spiral portion of it when these two objects are spinning around each other, and then right before they crash into each other, we call that the merger. And so as those huge objects are moving around in space at like unfathomable speeds, so these guys that we detected were moving at almost, I think it's about 0.5, the speed of light, half the speed of light, right before they crashed into each other. And they're just these small, compact objects. So for the first detection, the two black holes that we detected were 29 and 36 solar masses. And so I'm sure you know what that means. So 29 suns was how much one of them weighed, but they're compressed down to the size of maybe something, the diameter from here to Yakima for one of these black holes. And so it's a very small object, but it's very compact and very dense. And they're moving right before the merger, close to the speed of light, these two big, heavy objects. And so that's just a crazy thing to think about. I think this one is going to tell us kind of how the interferometer works, how our machine works. So when we do the tour today, we're going to go up to the control room or the corner station, or that's what we'll call that building. And so all of that stuff would be housed, all of these things would be housed in the corner station. And then these guys would be the mirrors or masses or optics, that's what we call them. And they're 4 kilometers away down the arms. And so this is a laser. This is called a beam splitter. This splits the light and such that it goes down both of the arms. I also have a small demo of it here, a small miniature version of it here. And then this is where we look at the output of this type of how this machine works. This is obviously very simplified. We don't see buildings. We don't see earthquakes that are happening in New Zealand shaking these mirrors around. So this is just very simple. And this is, like I said, it's a Michelson interferometer. This is actually this optical setup has been around for a century, I mean over 100 years. And we're using this setup, but it's much more complicated or much more complex to detect gravitational waves. Think of the wave nature of light. So that's what those kind of waves that you're seeing in there, in the two different colors. So you have red going down one arm, hitting the mirror, coming back. Same happened in the other arm, the blue wave. And then they recombine here. And right here you can see there's no light because the waves are kind of canceling each other out. But watch these mirrors here now. Watch, they're going to start moving. And as you do that, you can see that the waves positively and negatively interfere with each other. So you get to see light and no light. Light, no light. And so the distance changes that you're making with those mirrors is the thing that makes this thing such a perfect detector for gravitational waves, because the distance changes that we're going to be looking for are super tiny, because those violent events that happen, you know, a billion plus light years away were huge where it happened a billion years ago. But by the time they get here, by the time they pass through the universe and at the speed of light and eventually get here, they're very, 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 very tiny. And Einstein did go through equations, like he did go through the formulas to see if we could actually detect them, and he kind of wrote them off the year after the year after the general theory of relativity came out. And mainly it's because of a couple of things. So they didn't have the technology, they didn't have the type of that we have here, and then they didn't know about certain types of objects in astronomy. He used stars and tried to see what kind of gravitational waves would come from stars orbiting and crashing into each other. But since then, a lot of has happened as far as technology, and then as well as knowing about other types of events such as neutron stars and black holes and supernovas. And so that's why in the 60s, Ray Weiss came up with this kind of idea for making a detector to detect gravitational waves. And this is just another simulation of what we're looking at. So the waves are actually these green guys here. And you can see for right there, that's the biggest burst of waves that come from that event, right when they crashed. And they travel all through the universe, passing through different galaxies, stars, planets, and travel, you know, just unimpeded at the speed of light. And eventually, after 1.3 billion years, the event that we detected passed through the Earth. The Earth didn't shake like this. It's exaggerated. But right here is where the big event happened. And the mirrors at both end stations moved and jiggled enough so that we could see that here on this detector that we have there. That's when the merger happens right there, when it's the biggest waves passing through the Earth. And this is just one I made that just kind of does the same thing, but you can look inside the corner station with these pictures, so that's why I'm throwing this in. Amber, when do you think I should... 15? Okay. Okay. So here's an event. Here's two objects crashing into each other. Here are the waves coming from it. And then I have a few pictures. Here's that same picture of our detector. The mirrors are here. And when we're running, we have light resonating in the arms, and we're looking at the output here. So when an event happens, it's going to move those mirrors, and you'll see the light change, or the fringe pattern change back in the corner station here. So now we're going into the corner station, so this is what it looks like. We don't get to go here today because we have a machine that we're running, but the beam splitter would be inside this chamber here. the laser's over here, so beam splitter splits the light in two, so half of it goes down the Y arm, that's going towards Rattlesnake Mountain, and then the other half goes down the X arm, which is towards the bit plant, which is that way. And then when the mirrors are moved to cause those springs, that pattern to happen, the light comes back to the beam splitter, and then we see it down here around the corner, there's another chamber here. And so that other chamber is pictured here. These actually aren't the detectors that look at the light. They're actually kind of over here, suspended. These are mirrors, this is kind of a mirror here. These are other sensors, but they're not the photodetectors that look at the light. That's me.
Is that in real size?
What?
Is this an actual size?
That's me for perspective. Yeah, and yeah, so those mirrors, that's a 1-inch lens, just so you know. And then, yeah. So once that light comes back from the arms after they've been jostled around, hopefully by a gravitational wave, that light is going to go to a detector, and then can be converted to a voltage or a current. And once that happens, you could do different things with it. So gravitational waves don't make noise, but once you have that voltage or current to work with, you could do different things with it. You could hook it up into some speakers and listen to the noise that's happening. Or you could take it and graph what the voltage or currents are doing. So this is just another... when we go into the control room, hopefully there'll be some of these things up on the monitors on the walls. This is the one that operators always look at. It's just called a power spectrum. It's just a graph. And the things to look at are the horizontal axis here is frequency. And then this is just you can just think of it as amplitude of the machine. And so you can see 100 hertz here, 10 hertz here, 1,000. For us, we think of this as the bucket right here. So this is, we want this thing to be as low as we can get it. If we have a machine running and it's a windy day, this red trace will actually be very noisy. A lot of more peaks will be there. This thing would probably be shifted up a little bit more and kind of bouncing around. That's what a noisy day looks like. But if it's quiet, you're going to be right here over these reference traces that we have there. So that's, as an operator, we want to run the machine and get it down to as quiet as we can get it, so that if an event happens, that we could catch it within this frequency range. So the detection from a year ago, we saw it from about, I think, 40 hertz up to 250 hertz. And so that was another reason why it was perfect for us, because it was right in that bucket that we have here. So, you know, 40 hertz up to 250, so that's right where we want to see these types of events. And that's why Ray was so ingenious with coming up with this machine that we have, because it's actually also in the audible frequency as well, so you could listen to those frequencies too if we have events that happen in the bucket that we have. So this is the event. Almost a year ago. And then this is the data for Louisiana. And then here's the data for Hanford. So they're never going to let us forget it, but they actually detected the signal before us. So when the event happened, it passed through their machine first. So it jostled their mirrors around first, and then 7 milliseconds later, it came to our machine here and moved our mirrors around. And so, yeah, 2:50 in the morning here, and 4:50 in the morning in local time in Louisiana, we had this event that happened. I was there on shift. Like I said, there's 9 operators here. I've been here since 98. I'm one of the oldest operators that we have, so I'm the lead operator. So I pick shifts, I hire new operators, etc. So I was working from 4 p.m. to midnight that night. And it was a crazy day because there was some work that was being done during the day that afternoon and evening. But around 10 p.m., they said, "Corey, okay, it's yours. You can take it, lock it up, and start collecting data." And so that's what I got it to a point where we could collect data. And I think it was about 11 or 12 right before my shift was over. I didn't get to hit the button to say collecting data, but I handed it off to one of the newest hires that I hired. And so she came on at midnight, and then the event happened, you know, an hour or 2 hours and 50 minutes into her shift. And the thing is that we didn't know that. So I was probably asleep when this wave passed right through the earth. She was, I think she was just making a comic for one of the this magazine that she's doing outreach work for. So she didn't even know that it happened as well. But within a few minutes after this detection happened, those computers are always running. And so if we get a trigger is when you have, if you register an event on both machines, and it also has to be within 10 milliseconds too, and I'll talk about that later. But whenever we get triggers, the computers will send a flurry of emails around the globe. And so at 2:50, I mean, it's the middle of the night here, but in Germany, it's, I think, 11 in the morning or something like that. So some German physicists that were happened to be in their offices got these crazy emails that were telling them that something happened. And I mean, I guess the mindset would be is that this was probably us. Was this another a test that we were doing on our machine? And so I don't think there was a lot of excitement, but there was some. I mean, some of these younger people who are kind of new to LIGO were pretty excited to see these emails that came through. Oh yeah, this is just, if you put in the masses for these two black holes and the frequencies, that, you know, everything that you get from the actual data, this is the prediction that you get from Einstein's equations for gravity for those detections. You can see that it lines up pretty nice to our detection that we have. And if this is the data from both machines. Hanford is shifted so that they're lined up right on top of each other, and you can see how nice they look right on top of each other. And then Louisiana did make the detection first, but you can see that Hanford, which is in red, had the bigger signal. So, so think about all this that's going on. You have these huge, heavy, dense black holes that are moving at nearly the speed of light, and we're catching it right before they crash into each other. And we're only catching about 0.2 seconds of that event. I mean, these objects were probably generating gravitational waves for thousands or millions of years, but we didn't have a machine sensitive enough to detect any of that stuff. So our machines are good enough to catch it right before they crash into each other when the biggest waves are generated. And then you could also get a tattoo of the event. Until we made the announcement. So I got this when I was vacationing with my sister in Puerto Rico, and we both just did it. I think it was on Einstein's birthday, so I did.
Did Louisiana folks know? Did they detect it?
The operator on shift, he didn't know.
He didn't know.
But we have a network where we can listen. Anybody could call the control room. So the person in Germany did call the operator in Louisiana and ask them, how are things going? Is anything weird going on? So there was that communication that did happen. Yes.
We could have like a continuous data stream between the two sites so that you can, and who's doing the analysis?
Well, we have computers that are running that are collecting the data, but the computers don't really analyze and look at that data until the operator hits the button to say that the machine is good. There's no changes that are actively happening to the machine, and so that's one of the, so every time the machine breaks, sometimes we have to do an alignment. Other times we just let the scripts, we let the computer do everything, all the button pushing for us to get to a point, to get to that value where we're at the best sensitivity. That usually takes about 30 minutes for us to get there. So once, if I'm here in the control room here, once we get to that point, and I see that there's no activity going on site, nobody's driving a diesel truck down to the X arm, the XN station, if everything's quiet and good, then I'll hit the button to say that this machine is good to collect data. So then you have this one machine collecting data until it drops out again.
So you do the analysis here, or the computations are done here, or?
I think they're sent off-site. I think the supercomputer network that we have goes down to Caltech.
I see.
And then it's distributed from there. Yeah. But yeah, but I think we also need to have both of them up as well. So when both of them up, that's when the data is sent down there and it's analyzed and all kinds of templates are thrown on that data. And so this is just another way of looking at it. This is a spectrogram. This is looking at time. And this is the frequency that we have here. So yeah, you can see it's about 40 hertz up to almost 500 hertz. And then we can can actually, like I said, we can listen to it. Gravitational waves don't make, they don't make noise, but it's a voltage and a current to us, so we can do what we want with it.
It's alive.
So that's the actual data. So there's nothing that's been done with it. And so it's kind of lower frequency. So one thing that we did do is we shifted it up, everything up in frequency. So it's a little easier for our ears to listen to.
So are those two graphs separated by 7 milliseconds? The difference, I mean,
they've been shifted.
The correction for light travel.
Yeah, I mean, so the distance between both sites is 3,000 kilometers. How are we doing, Amber? Okay, I probably got 5 or 10 more minutes. So we have that distance known. So I was going to use a globe.
10 milliseconds.
But maybe I'll just think of, if we think of this whole audience as the United States, which is part of the Earth, and let's think of you as Louisiana, the one detector in Louisiana, and then the person in the back corner back there as Washington State. So for this particular event, or let's say we'll go to an extreme. So if we had one event that was coming from this part of the universe and just going through here, you'd see it first, and then because we know the speed of light and the distance to the other detector here, 10 milliseconds later, we would get it at the detector over there. So that's one way, that's the whole reason that we have that trigger. So if anything's longer than 10 milliseconds, we don't count it. So if we had something that was detected in Louisiana and then happened 5 seconds here later here, we won't count that as a trigger, because it could be something else. It could be something that's not moving at the speed of light.
Have you looked at pairs where you've done the analysis for 5 second, 10 second, 15 second, let's say, just to make sure that you're not seeing a fluke here, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that happened. I mean, we took several months to go through the data and vet it and make sure that we have thousands of instruments that we also have running all the time. We have microphones, magnetometers, and many other things that we went through just to make sure that it couldn't be anything else environmentally, or it couldn't be a lightning, huge lightning strike somewhere on the planet that could have caused something like that. So all of that stuff was vetted for months, and that's in the realm of the data analysis. Or you can talk to our scientists when we get up to the control room too. But yeah, so like I was saying, 10 milliseconds is the cutoff point. So because we have two machines, we get ideas of roughly where these events happen. So that was one extreme where it was something happened way out there, hit this young lady there, and then went over there. And so that's one extreme. Or you could have another one where it's kind of right in between both, and it hits both detectors at the same time. That would kind of tell you it's kind of either this way or on the other side of the Earth hitting the detectors at the same time. Or it could have been the opposite, where it's going this way. You feel it first. Hopefully that will happen soon for us, where we detect it first, and then Louisiana hits it. So that's one thing to think about with our setup that we have.
So for your wrench turning made this system more sensitive.
All of our wrench turning. I'm not going to just claim that.
Turns out it's the ground.
To a current or voltage? It's just hitting a photodetector. And so when that light hits that detector, when those mirrors are moving, they're going to cause that wave that we would see as, you know, light and dark fringes that are happening at the corner station. And then that is what we see on the detector, and that's where we get the waveform from it. So that's where we get this guy from both. Yeah. So I just want to play this one more time. And higher frequency. And then just shift it in frequency. Easier to hear. And like what I was talking to, we can't totally pinpoint where the event happened because we're not an optical detector. We can't look and see where we're looking at. But we can get ideas depending on how many detectors that we have. So roughly, this event, the Earth was in the middle here. This is kind of the slice of the pie that in the sky where the event happened. So it's kind of big, but with two detectors, is what we saw. But if we had 3 or 5 or 10 more detectors, this would get smaller and smaller and smaller, so that we would have a very good idea of where this event happened in space. So we'd have a very big idea there. And that's important because if instead of black holes, this was a supernova explosion or two neutron stars, then optically we could share this information with our counterparts who are looking at electromagnetic waves. And so we could send emails to these other observatories and have them point their dishes or telescopes in a certain part of the sky to look for these events, just so that we can have other ways of looking at the same event. And I kind of already talked about this, what we have right now. So Hanford and Livingston at Sligo, and then GEO is also online. Virgo is hopefully going to happen in the next few months. And then Kagra in Japan. And India is the furthest one away, so I don't think they've broken ground there yet. And I kind of already talked about this. So 3,000 kilometers and then 10 milliseconds is that's the cutoff point for when we for what triggers we allow. I don't know if I'm going to... Okay, we'll play this real quick. So you can watch this here. Here's where we're at on the event here, the waveform. And then you can see the amount of space that's being curved by those two black holes in space there. And you can see that right here, right now. And right before they merge, that's when you get the hugest signal. And we only saw a couple cycles here because it was big enough for our machine to detect it. And this is slowed down right before it happens, right before the two black holes merge. Right here. One cycle. That's kind of a peak. Right there. And then these are the gravitational waves, and the color is kind of telling you how big their amplitudes are. So the pink spot is the one that we have on my arm, and then also on both detectors. And so that's the one that was big enough for us to detect on our machines. So then, briefly, I want to just go over this too. Yeah.
So would an act of aurora borealis, if the northern lights or southern lights or anything were really active, would that affect this too? Your data?
Yeah.
Or no?
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't think so, but I don't know. We have tons, many scientists who think about all types of contingencies. So we control our mirrors electronically, and there's a quad out there. So a quad is the what one of the masses look like. And so we had one scientist go out to the power lines that were out here along Route 10 just to make sure that the electricity from electric fields from those power lines don't affect our optics here, which are 8 miles away from that. And they don't, luckily. But that's a good question. No, I'll write that down or ask. So I don't know if we're going to have this plot in the control room because everything's down. But when you walk in the control room, that other plot, the power spectrum's in the front, and to the left is going to be this one. So when I'm sitting in the chair and Fred or my boss comes in, they'll look at this and they'll say, Corey, what's going on? Or Corey, what are you doing? Are you goofing off? Because this is going to tell you how things have been going for the last 24 hours. So this would be now. And then this would be 24 hours ago. And this is actually what it looked like on September 14th, a year ago when the detection happened. And so red is us. Red is us here. Green is Louisiana. And then this is what that day looked like. So every minute, we get a data point that goes up there. And so we get an update every minute. And you can see that, for the most part, H1, which is what we call Hanford here, was up for most of the day. And we were doing pretty good at just under 80 megaparsecs, and these are some distances here. We just think of these numbers here, so 80. Let's see. We did pretty good there. And so the event happened at 9:50 UTC, so it's like Greenwich Mean Time, so that's right about here.
Louisiana was
and you can see that right here. I mean, we were doing pretty good, but you can see Louisiana had a rough day, so they were doing stuff here, probably active measurements, and then right here they're up for a couple hours. And we lucked out that both machines were up at that particular time. And so it was, I never looked at this until like a few months after, and I was like, whoa, we just totally lucked out on that one because of Louisiana. Oh, okay. So keep this red trace in mind here. So this is looking at this is just a tool, and we thought neutron stars would be the type of mergers that we'd be looking at first. That those would be the first detections we have. And so for neutron stars, this is how far out we can look for neutron stars, which are about 1.5 solar masses each as they're crashing into each other. But there's other types of events. So this is Hanford again. And that plot that we just saw is this one, the blue one, 80 megaparsecs. But Everything depends on the type of events that are involved. And so we have binary neutron stars here, neutron star binary, or a black hole here, so that's a neutron star and a black hole spinning around. These are the masses, 1.4 and 10. And then green is two black holes that are 10 solar masses each. And that one, you can see, because they're so much more heavier, they're going to cause a much bigger gravitational signal. And so with for 10 solar mass black holes, we can go out to, you know, under 400 megaparsecs. But the black holes that we detected were, you know, three times more than that, 29 and 36. So we could see even further for bigger black holes. And so that was an interesting thing. I mean, you could see in this plot that we generated, binaries could be on this order because, I mean, you guys, I know there's a lot of astronomers here. I think a lot of the black holes that we thought are out there are either are on that order, you know, around 10 solar masses or somewhere near there, or are super huge in the center of galaxies. So the ones that we detected are 36 and 29. So that was a bit of a surprise too. And so that's why we didn't even have that tool up for that. And then I guess you'd call these guys the fathers of LIGO. And so Ray Wise is the one who kind of had the idea of building a machine, going into the theoretical physics and astrophysics of the type of events is Kip Thorne. This is when he was doing work for that movie Interstellar. And then Ron Drever is another physicist from Glasgow who helped run our project down in Caltech as well. So these are the three that we should always be, keep an ear out for, especially when the Nobel Prize might be announced next year or this year. But Ray is awesome. I wish I had the time to show you a video of him. He is such a character. I mean, he's sharp, he's super funny, he's really fast-witted, and he's just a really cool and very approachable person to meet. So he's still one of my heroes. Okay, and feel free to take pictures of these. These are the web pages to go to get us a couple of documents of interest. So this is the actual paper. This is where you get the actual paper that came from the first event. And then this is our most recent magazine that we have. And you can grab the PDFs of those online. And I'm sorry, I probably ran a little longer than I was hoping to. So I think we're going to probably stretch our legs next. And maybe, what do you think we should do, Amber?
Find a leak.
Helium. Probably.
Yep.
Could be.
Pick up the helium leak detector, you
spray it down, a little bit of helium on the outside, and just pulling it from the inside, and
it'll detect that.
I know all the welds and things like that had to be x-rayed because of that exact thing. We're looking for those problems beforehand and stuff like that. So, it's great. You can walk down and take a picture. I'll also walk you up to the arms, which to me is the best view on site. The most amazing thing I think on site to look at. This is where you want to take your pictures. Mom? But notice right over there, that's all our air conditioners. And the reason they're there is the closer they are to the building, the more they cause vibrations in our machines. So we want them as far away as possible from us. But it looks neat.
All right, so you can only bounce back and forth so many times.
And we are looking to upgrade farther too. So the laser power we're doing incrementally, and it will be much larger in the next few runs as well.
So how do you turn it on? Any time to bounce back and forth?
It has to do with the moves themselves and how much they screw it on. Right now it's around 280.
Right, essentially the power level of the resin.
Yeah.
Underground a ways after that?
No, wall. It's actually all above ground. It just happens to be with where we are that you can't see it. But this is 2 kilometers out. The in station would be 4 kilometers.
And so that one's 4 kilometers from the building?
The first one you see is 2, but if you look way out and where you can only just see that little piece of a roof, that's the 4 kilometers. It's kind of hard to see. Yeah, that little thing. So the first building you see is the 2 kilometer mark. Oh. And then if you look out, you'll see the 4 kilometers. One of the stories that they told me when I first came out here was they started noticing in their data there was this weird bump every day at the same time of day, weird bump, and they couldn't figure out what the bump was. So they send people out to hunt the bumps down. They have to figure out where it's coming from. So they went, and what they finally figured out is there was a speed bump in the parking lot, and every day at the same time, people were going over it with their car. So they had to take the bump out, level it out, put it. When they repaved this road up here, they worked very closely with everybody, and so they went and asked them to level out a couple dips, because there was these dips that the semis would hit, and it would cause a spike in our data as well. So they talked to the road company to get them to level it out a little bit as well. So we try to have really good relationships with everybody to help us out. Livingston talks to the logging companies and helps, like when they're in a run, the logging companies will try to log a little farther away if they can. And try to quiet when they're doing things because it helps them out. Look on that side, see how there's not very much? You look on this side, that burned about 5 years ago and it burned up to the arm. Huh. And you can see a substantial difference in the landscape, the vegetation, because of that. So we do have to deal with wildfires out here for sure. Yeah, it's about a thousand of them.
Yeah, still sounds impossible to me.
This is one of the things that I love the scale, because we're going from detecting things that are the size of 39 solar masses, or 36, using 4 kilometer arms, and we're looking for a fluctuation of 10 to the negative 19. Exactly. Yes, we get a lot more out of it because of that. And the curve in 4 kilometers, the curvature of the Earth comes into play. Uh-huh. So we had to pay attention to that when we were building. So the scale is very mind-boggling. Awesome.
Okay, so welcome to the control room. My name is Sheila Dwyer. I'm a postdoc here. And I mainly work on trying to make sure that it runs reliably and keeping the noise down. This is Natsumi. She's one of our operators. She's the operator who is here in the middle of the night when the first and she's here today because we had a power outage last night. This is why things don't work. Like, they don't really do when you walk in the control room. So on a normal day, if you walk in here, kind of look around curious, spending a lot of time here. normally we'd have seismic information over in that corner. So we can see earthquakes all over the world. They make it hard for us to run if they're larger than something like a 5 or 6. We've seen explosions or whatever happens. So just local explosions or even, you know, like the recent big explosions in North Korea, we can see those clearly. We're also affected by the wind, so we watch that. The wind actually pushes on our buildings and shakes it. It gets quite windy here sometimes, and you can hear the buildings. That confuses our control system because we try to keep our platforms flat against the ground, so when the wind pushes the building, it gets confused. Right now we're in what we call a commissioning phase, so we're not trying to run and observe gravitational waves. We're trying to make our instrument more sensitive. So we measure the amplitude of gravitational waves, and that means that when we're running, we look out a certain distance in the universe. It's basically like a microphone. We can hear from almost anywhere out of the sky. So if we make our detector a little bit less noisy, you know, say we made it a factor of 2 less noisy, we can look a factor of 2 further in the universe, and that means we get, you know, 8 times more volume of space that we're observing. And that's something that's really great about gravitational waves. You know, they've been really hard to detect. So we're really late compared to optical astronomers. You know, you can just look outside and you can see them, the stars. But, you know, it took 100 years for us to be able to detect gravitational waves since Einstein first figured out that they should be out there. But now that we're able to detect them and hear, the technology is something that can be extended pretty well. And because we measure amplitude instead of the power, we can see things that are further away more clearly. So what I'm saying, as a star is further away, the light that you can detect from it drops as the distance squared. But because of the way we detect our signal, it drops as just the distance. So actually, if you made this detector much longer and much more sensitive with some, you know, new technologies, you could see further back in the history of the universe than any optical astronomers can easily see. So we could see back to the very first stars, potentially. You know, if this was, say, a factor of 10 longer, something like that. What else? Oh yeah, so that's when you got the seismic information. So you can see there were 2 small earthquakes last night. Those could be something like, you know, something like 4 local. So the first one you can see nearby, and you can see it's both here on the top and the higher again on the bottom. And the second one was then the middle screen here, did I talk about the middle screen? That's our sensitivity, so that's one of the most important plots we have. So the frequency of gravitational wave we're trying to detect is on the horizontal axis, and then the noise we're trying to detect is on the vertical axis. But this isn't line, this red line, so we have this, the purple lines there are a calculation of what our best sensitivity could be. And the yellow line is the best, well, is the normal sensitivity during our run last time, the last fall. Or actually, this was in February, it's slightly better than the best during the run. The blue one is from Louisiana, and then the red one is normally by, but right now it's not by. you know, feed it back to push back and keep that in place. And most of those are digital loops. There's a few that are too fast. Like, so we control our laser frequency up to a megahertz. Well, we can. We find that it's a little better to go lower, but we can. So that's analog electronics that are all out on the floor. There's, you know, settings we can change from here, but all the feedback is handled out there because it's too slow to come bring the signal all the way here, bring it out. Most of our control loops are slower, sort of 100 hertz kind of feedback, so we correct 100 times a second for whatever we see. And that you can do digitally, so all the signals get recorded digitally. That's way easier because, you know, when you need to change something, you just type in some new filters in your digital system, they get applied, and then you can make a change. Instead of an analog electronics, you're gonna have to go out there, pull out the board, and think about what components you want to replace. So this is much easier, but you can't go as fast.
Why did you choose 1,000 nanometers for the wavelength of the laser?
Okay. There's a couple of things that make it hard, and I mean, that constrain your choice. One is that the lasers are very stable at 1064 is our wavelength.
What kind of laser is it?
The base part of the laser is an NPRO, so it's a...
I mean, is it a gas, solid, crystal, or what? In what material?
It's a solid. It's a one crystal that makes up a cavity. So it's a solid crystal that the light circulates in, and that's what makes it very stable.
And what do you pump it with then?
We use 803 nanometers.
Another laser?
Yeah, another laser that's not as stable. So there's the laser, and then there are several amplifier stages that are pumped with that 803 nanometers and amplify it up to 200 watts. One of the main constraints is that you have to get a piece of glass that has very low absorption for that wavelength because of the thermal problems. We don't want very high absorption. And so fused silica is the glass that we use, and that's one of the best types of glass that's very transparent for 1064. In the future, we might want to use like cryogenic operations. So because every material has a temperature and every molecule in those materials are moving, that causes eliminating noises. If you cool that down, you do a little better. But you can't use fused silica to cool down. So we'd have to find a new laser to go with that new material to work at cryogenic temperature. So finding a set of everything, we need detectors, lasers, and material that all work together is kind of a challenge. But people are working on doing that for the next generation to see what we could do next.
Do you select a frequency count then out of the laser with never throw or something similar?
Yeah. Actually, our laser in the end is probably, this is incredibly stable compared to most lasers. So, you know, a good laser, 100 kilohertz line wave or something. So we actually use the 4 kilometer arms in the end. We have fiber throw as a reference to stabilize our laser too. So we have differential motion of the arms, that's what's sensitive to gravitational waves. And the common motion of the arms, we use it to stabilize our laser. There are many, many loops around each other, but in the end we have, our laser line width is something like a hertz, less than a hertz. So that's a very quiet laser.
How far away from the black hole collision you have to be to not get killed by the tidal forces?
Oh. I don't know the answer to that.
Is 1 light year enough, or do you have to be a lot further?
I don't know, but I don't think 1 light year would be enough. I don't know. Let's see. I don't know the answer to that. Did some MIT professor just walk in the back? No. I don't know how close it would be.
When all systems are going, what are the roles of everybody? Is this room filled with people, or tell me what it looks like?
Oh, yeah. Right, so somebody like NASA would be, that's our operator station right there. So there's a main operator station, and there's one computer next to it where usually if the operator needs support, or we have a We have detector engineers, we have people like me, we call it commissioners. So the operator is there 24/7, and there's people on call, detector engineers, commissioners on call, and, you know, usually we can just talk on the phone and work through whatever it is. People can also plug in remotely, but if need be, somebody will drive in the middle of the night to sit there with the operator. Right now, during commission time, like, actually yesterday, I came in kind of late. We work late a lot because not everybody can work at the same time. When people need to work out on the floor, people like me can't really do much, so we work shift too. And I came in around 10 a.m., and there was not a single machine that I could use in here. There was somebody at every station. So that's unusual. That's because we're trying to ramp up and get ready for the run in about a month or so. We're trying to detect more gravitational waves then. So we have a lot of visitors right now. Yeah, it kind of be, we have, you know, two shifts today. We always have two people in here, and then the owl shift from midnight to 8 a.m. There's just one operator who's here and people who are on call. But during the daytime, there's usually
so one person can run the whole thing, and it's really working nicely.
Yeah, when it's working nicely, one person can run the whole thing. When it's really working nicely, the computer can run it, but that doesn't.
So we need operators. How do you go about, you mentioned the earthquakes and things like that, how do you go about determining whether there are pinpoints around the world and pinpointing that?
For a detection, you mean?
Yeah.
So we have a whole array of sensors, environmental sensors, around the site. So magnetic fields, radio waves, cosmic rays, of course all the, we have microphones, did I say magnetometers? And we inject all kinds of noise to see how it shows up in our detector and how it shows up in the sensor. And then when an event arrives, you can look at the sensors and you can say, you know, if that had been caused by my magnetic field, I know I would have seen it at this level in the sensor. And, you know, we can say there was no magnetic field like that. And then for the first detections, people wanted to be sort of extra careful, so there was, you know, a lot of extra stuff and checking things. There turned out to be a really huge lightning strike, a really unusual lightning strike in Burkina Faso at around the same time, at very close to our detection time. So that was something that caused a lot of discussion, but we know that we had all these sensors set up that it couldn't have caused the signal that we saw.
So this is this area is in a radio blackout area for radio waves for like amateur and CB or podcast.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I don't know.
Radio wave hypersensitive. Does it have a hypersensitive impact here?
There are certain frequencies that we have an impact. We set up actually Robert, one of the scientists who's here today, they set up a little radio station, so they broadcast it and try to see how it shows up in our sensors, all of our on-site sensors and also in the signal. And there are certain frequencies that we use. We modulate our light and then demodulate it to make our air signal. So we use radio frequencies for that. And some of them are approaching what you might have for commercial radio frequencies. So they did a very careful scan, like broadcasting all different frequencies and seeing what we could pick up. And then we have a monitor that's constantly monitoring the radio environment. So we're confident that that's ruled out, but there are certain frequencies where it would be a problem if somebody was using some kind of artifact. Any other questions? Oh, I didn't tell you. So, Corey gave you your talk. Yesterday, our engineering team just found out they got a big prize from the Optical Society of America. So, you got a tour from an award-winning engineer. So, congratulations.
So, So you get some 60 cycle noise in there.
Oh yeah, we do. We try all of our electronics are remote, so that you know everything AC powered is out in this remote room, and everything on the field is powered by DC power. But there's the power lines from the generating station over there go right by us, so we pick that up. It's actually unfortunate because the crab pulsar, gravitational waves are sort of twice the frequency, the orbital frequency of a star, and the crab pulsar is kind of right around 60 hertz. It moves a little bit, so we can still have sensitivity because we know how the frequency of the crab changes. But that's one of our, that would be a really nice pulsar to be able to monitor. But we have our European friends in Italy are, should be coming out and joining us soon. They're, you know, the power lines are at 50 hertz, so hopefully. Any other last questions? Or I think Amber.
No, I'll just say if you have no other questions, I'll take you back up front. Any questions you have about stuff inside that you may have looked at before the talk, you're welcome to ask me, and I'll tell you everything I can know.
Thank you.